At Lowe's, before the holidays is the perfect time for upgrades and upkeep. During Black Friday, get up to 50% off select major appliances and buy more to save more with up to an additional 25% off when you bundle select major appliances. Plus, grab select DeWalt 20-volt max drill or impact driver kits for just $99. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 12/3. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details.
Patience here.
Oh, boy, got some blood going.
Yeah, there's blood.
He's wearing it, too.
Welcome to the bed. When you get over to the bed, we'll go ahead and give you the story. This is all going to happen super fast. Welcome to the emergency room.
70-year-old female, single driver of a vehicle. Appearance that she went off-road into a ditch, rolled over her car onto a tree, caved in the top of the vehicle, or was caved in, so she was hanging out partially from the window.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. If you are preparing for high-stakes acute care, maybe a medical surgical exam, getting certified, or, you know, just being ready for your patients, you know, the first absolute priority is the trauma airway.
Mm-hmm.
Today, we're doing a deep dive into really the 20% of info in trauma airway management that gives you like 80% of the successful outcomes.
That's exactly right. You asked for a high yield review, zeroing in on immediate life-saving actions, especially the nursing implications and those critical little details.
Yeah.
And the sources, well, they're crystal clear. Inadequate oxygenated blood to the brain.
Mm-hmm.
That's the quickest killer in trauma, period.
Right.
So securing that airway, getting oxygen in, supporting ventilation, it takes priority over absolutely everything else. It's where we have to start.
Okay, let's unpack this then. Before we even jump into doing things, let's look at failure. What are the big mistakes, the key failures in that acute phase that lead to preventable deaths? What are we actually trying to stop here?
Well, the sources really highlight these critical moments, these decision points where things go wrong. Often it boils down to failures in like anticipating the threat or not recognizing the need for intervention soon enough,
mm-hmm.
or maybe just failing to manage the equipment correctly. And critically for the nurse, we often see failures in assessment, maybe not spotting a developing obstruction.
Right.
And then maybe even after intubation, failing to recognize that the tube got displaced.
That difference between, you know, sudden failure and that slower progressive failure seems really important. It's not always a dramatic immediate thing, is it?
Precisely, yeah. While trauma can cause a sudden complete blockage, often we're dealing with damage that's more insidious.
Like burns.
Exactly. Think about facial burns or inhalation injuries. The patient might be talking fine initially, right?
Mm-hmm.
But we know that swelling can just clamp down on that airway hours later.
Mm.
And in those cases, the failure is waiting too long. You need preemptive intubation because once that edema locks down the larynx, getting a tube in becomes nearly impossible.
So recognizing the threat early is key. We're relying on clinical cues. What are the immediate signs we absolutely have to spot? And is there like a gold standard sign that tells us we might have a little breathing room, at least for a moment?
The most reassuring sign, the one that gives you that sort of momentary confidence, is the talking patient.
Okay.
A positive, appropriate verbal response, clear voice.
Yeah.
It suggests a patent airway, good ventilation, and enough brain perfusion. That's your first quick assessment cue.
Momentary confidence, yeah.
Right.
Because right after that, we're looking for the subtle things, the early signs that things are starting to go sideways.
Yeah, and often those subtle signs are changes in breathing rate or maybe behavior. We look for rapid, shallow breathing tachypnea. That tells you the body's struggling for oxygen.
Mm-hmm.
We also look for changes in mental status, agitation, restlessness. That might signal hypoxia, the brain's starving for O2.
But isn't tachypnea pretty common in, well, any distressed trauma patient? How do we know if it's specifically an airway problem versus, say, just pain or shock?
That's a really critical question. While tachypnea itself isn't specific, you're right. But if it's combined with changes in their level of consciousness, then the airway system is almost certainly involved.
Okay.
Obtundation?
Mm.
You know, the patient becoming quiet, sleepy, that often suggests hypercarbia, too much CO2 building up.
Ah.
And the difference is really key. If they're agitated, thrashing, they need oxygen. If they're getting quiet, sleepy. The enemy is CO2 buildup from failing ventilation. That difference really guides what you do next.
And the late signs. The ones we really hope never to see.
Cyanosis, that's a late finding of hypoxemia. Yeah. And remember the nuance here. It can be really hard to spot in pigmented skin, so you have to check places like nail beds around the mouth.
Right, Dave.
But if you see it, you're already way behind the curve.
Mm.
Noisy breathing, like snoring, gurgling, or stridor, indicates a partial blockage.
Okay, what do those different sounds mean?
Gurgling means fluid blood, vomit. Snoring usually means the tongue's relaxed and blocking the back of the throat. And stridor, that high-pitched sound, that implies laryngeal obstruction, often from swelling. Very serious.
This brings us to the definite trigger point. When is there just no question we have to secure this airway now?
Well, high-risk groups include anyone with an altered level of consciousness, maybe from alcohol, drugs, or a head injury. Their protective gag reflexes are likely gone, putting them at huge risk for aspiration.
Mm-hmm.
But the absolute non-negotiable threshold is a Glasgow Coma Scale score, GCS of 8 or less.
GCS 8 or less.
Yeah. GCS less than 8 means you intubate promptly,
mm-hmm.
provide that definitive airway, deliver oxygen, support breathing, and crucially, prevent aspiration. No question.
Okay, so now we know what to look for. How do we actually measure the extent of the problem? What are the first tools we grab in those initial minutes?
We have to go beyond just looking. Chest rise, is it symmetrical? If it's not, that suggests a big problem like a pneumothorax or flail chest.
Mm.
We listen for breath sounds. Are they decreased? Absent. That alerts us to serious lung issues.
Mm-hmm.
And pulse oximetry, of course, it's essential for measuring oxygen saturation.
But there's always a but with pulse ox, isn't there?
There is. Here's the major clinical caveat. Oximetry does not measure how well the patient is ventilating, how well they're clearing CO2.
Okay.
Plus, it's unreliable if the patient's severely vasoconstricted, like in shock, or profoundly anemic, or critically in carbon monoxide poisoning. It can look normal when things are very wrong.
So given those limitations, especially in trauma, what is the single most reliable measurement we should be using for ventilation adequacy?
Capnography.
Right.
Measuring end-tidal CO2. It's absolutely crucial.
Okay.
You use it in patients breathing on their own to see how well they're ventilating, and it is mandatory in intubated patients, both to check ventilation adequacy and, maybe even more importantly, to confirm the tube is in the right place. It's a critical nursing assessment tool showing gas exchange.
Let's talk immediate management. Every trauma patient, potentially a C-spine injury, that mandatory cervical spine restriction, how does that change our basic life-saving airway moves?
Now it changes everything. Restriction of C-spine motion is mandatory for all trauma patients at risk. This means no hyperextending the neck to open the airway. You can't do that.
So what can you do?
You have to rely on the chin lift maneuver, pulling the chin forward without tilting the head back, or the jaw thrust maneuver, pushing the jaw forward. Both need constant awareness to keep that spine stable.
And what if that patient, the one with the suspected C-spine injury, suddenly starts vomiting? That's a nightmare scenario, massive aspiration risk.
Yeah.
How do you handle the clash between preventing aspiration and protecting the spine?
You always have to anticipate vomiting. Always. The immediate priority, suction. Instantly.
Okay.
And here's the key intervention cue. You must rotate the entire patient, move them like a log, and block onto their side while someone else maintains that C-spine restriction.
Not just turn the head.
Absolutely not. You move the whole trunk and head together. That's how you manage aspiration risk while keeping the spine aligned. And obviously, you absolutely must have functional tested suction ready to go before you need it.
We talked about anticipation earlier, and predicting failure seems vital. If we think we might need a definitive airway, how do we quickly check if a standard intubation attempt is likely to be difficult before we even grab the laryngoscope?
That's exactly why the Lemon assessment is so high yield. It's a quick, structured way to predict a difficult intubation. It gives the team a heads up, time to get rescue gear ready, or maybe even consider a surgical airway right from the start.
Okay, let's break down Lemon. L is for look externally.
Right, you're looking for obvious signs of trouble.
Uh-huh.
Significant facial or jaw trauma, a big overbite, maybe a really short, thick neck, or just a small mouth opening. Just scanning for those external red flags.
E is for evaluate the 3-3-2 rule. This sounds very testable.
It is. It basically assesses if there's enough space for the scope and visualization. Can you fit 3 of the patient's fingers between their front teeth? Can you fit 3 fingers between their hyoid bone, that bone in the neck, and the chin?
Mm-hmm.
And can you fit 2 fingers between the thyroid notch, the Adam's apple area, and the floor of the mouth? If they can't meet those clearances, it strongly predicts a tough intubation.
M is for malampati.
This looks at how well you can see the back of the throat, the hypopharynx. Now, it's often tough to do formally in an uncooperative trauma patient, but even a quick glance can give you a clue.
What are the classes?
Class I is best you see everything, soft palate, uvula, pillars. Class I is worst, you only see the hard palate. That basically means you should expect zero view during laryngoscopy. Prepare accordingly.
O is for obstruction.
Pretty straightforward. Is there anything physically blocking the way? Like a massive neck hematoma, a suspected laryngeal fracture, severe swelling from burns or anaphylaxis, anything making it hard to see or pass the tube.
And finally, N is for neck mobility.
Right. Restricted movement makes intubation much harder. And remember, this applies automatically to every patient who needs C-spine precautions.
Good point.
So if you already have a look external challenge, and now they also have restricted neck movement, your backup plan, your rescue plan, needs to be ready right now.
This flows perfectly into definitive management. What are the specific criteria that officially define a definitive airway?
Okay, four things. One, a tube placed in the trachea. Two, the cuff inflated below the vocal cords. Three, it's connected to oxygen-enriched assisted ventilation. And four, the tube is secured properly.
And the triggers for needing one?
Usually summed up by the B, C, D triggers.
Mm-hmm.
B for inability to maintain airway patency. C for inadequate oxygenation or ventilation, like apnea. D for decreased level of consciousness, like obtundation or combativeness from poor brain perfusion. Or D also for head injury with that GCS less than 8, mainly to protect from aspiration.
We usually prefer the orotracheal route, putting the tube in the mouth. But why is going through the nose sometimes an absolute no-go in trauma?
The nasotracheal intubation is incredibly risky if you even suspect certain facial fractures, specifically facial, frontal sinus, basilar skull, or cribriform pleat fractures.
So what signs should the nurse look for?
Classic signs. Raccoon eyes, bruising around the eyes, battle sign bruising behind the ear, or any sign of CSF leakage, like clear fluid from the nose, rhinorrhea, or ear euduria.
And the danger.
If you push a tube through the nose with those fractures, you risk sending it straight up into the cranial vault. Catastrophic bleeding or infection. Just don't do it if those signs are present.
Okay, let's talk rapid sequence intubation, RSI. This is for when the patient needs that definitive airway, but they still have reflexes, like a gag reflex. We need to sedate and paralyze them quickly. What's the vital sequence and the key drug details?
Sequence is critical. Non-negotiable. First step, pre-oxygenate. Flood them with 100% O2 for several minutes if possible.
Okay.
Second, often cricoid pressure is applied. The idea is to press on the cricoid cartilage to pinch off the esophagus and reduce aspiration risk. But, and this is important, it can sometimes worsen the view for the person intubating.
So they might ask you to adjust or release it.
Exactly. The airway manager has to guide that. Then come the drugs, induction agent first. Then the paralytic.
Induction and paralysis. Which drugs?
For induction, you need rapid sedation. But ideally, something that doesn't tank their blood pressure or raise intracranial pressure, especially in trauma. Etomidate at 0.3 milligy a kilogram is often the go-to.
Why etomidate?
Because it generally doesn't negatively affect BP or ICP. That's huge in trauma.
Mm-hmm.
One nursing point. Watch for possible transient adrenal suppression, though usually not clinically significant with one dose.
Okay, then the paralytic.
Immediately after sedation, you give the paralytic, usually succinylcholine, 1 to 2 milligy kilogram.
Succinylcholine, that's a really fast-acting one, right? Short duration. Why is that short duration so important, and what's the biggest safety issue with it?
Yes, rapid onset works in under a minute, and the short duration, less than 5 minutes usually, is your safety net. If, God forbid, you can't get the tube in, you know the patient will start breathing again on their own relatively quickly. That paralysis window, though, that's your moment of maximum danger. And the biggest pitfall, the absolute contraindication or extreme caution situation. It's the risk of severe, life-threatening hyperkalemia, high potassium.
When does that happen?
You have to be incredibly careful or avoid succinylcholine completely in patients with conditions causing widespread muscle breakdown or receptor upregulation. Think severe crush injuries, major burns, bad electrical injuries, or patients with chronic paralysis or chronic kidney failure.
Why?
Because in those patients, succinylcholine can cause a massive sudden release of potassium from the muscles into the bloodstream. That potassium surge can trigger immediate cardiac arrest.
Yeah.
It's a killer.
Wow. Okay. So if intubation does fail after you've given the paralytic, what's the mandatory first rescue step before you even think about cutting the neck?
If the definitive attempt fails, your immediate response is bag mask ventilation. You must reoxygenate the patient. Mm. Keep bagging them effectively until the paralysis wears off or until you can establish another airway.
Yeah.
But if the airway is truly lost, like you can't ventilate with a bag mask because of severe swelling, massive trauma, blocking the view, something like that, then you have to move quickly to a surgical airway.
And when we talk surgical airways, what's the difference between the main emergency procedure and the temporary fix?
The preferred emergency surgical airway, the gold standard when you can't intubate from above, is the surgical cricothyroidotomy. You make an incision through the cricothyroid membrane.
Why that one?
It's generally faster, technically easier, and has less bleeding risk than an emergency tracheostomy in this setting. It's the definitive surgical solution in a can't intubate, can't oxygenate scenario.
Any limitations?
Yes, a critical detail.
Yeah.
Generally not recommended for young children, typically under 12, because of the risk of damaging their developing cricoid cartilage, which is essential for larynx stability.
Okay, and the temporary fix?
That's the needle cricothyroidotomy, sometimes called percutaneous transtracheal oxygenation, or PTO. You insert a large bore catheter through the membrane.
How long does that buy you?
It's only a bridge. It provides oxygenation, maybe for 30 to 45 minutes max, but it's not a long-term solution. The big limitation is the patient can't exhale CO2 effectively through that narrow needle.
Ah, so CO2 builds up.
Exactly, which can be really dangerous, especially if they also have a head injury where high CO2 is harmful. So needle crick is temporary, buys time for a definitive airway like a surgical crick or intubation if conditions change.
Let's talk verification. The tube is in, you think. How does the team, and the nurse specifically, absolutely confirm it's in the right place before the paralytic wears off?
Okay, first, inflate the cuff, connect the bag or vent, and start ventilating. Then, initial screen is auscultation. Listen for equal breath sounds on both sides of the chest.
And
critically, listen over the epigastrium of the stomach. You should hear nothing. If you hear gurgling or barygmy, that tube is in the esophagus. Pull it out immediately.
Auscultation is suggestive, helpful, but what's the absolute definitive gold standard confirmation?
A carbon dioxide detector. End-tidal CO2 monitoring, either quantitative capnography, showing a waveform and number, or at least a qualitative colorimetric CO2 device. That's required.
How does it work?
If the tube is in the trachea, the lungs will exhale CO2 and the device will detect it. If it's in the esophagus, there should be minimal to no CO2 after the first few breaths. Presence of CO2 confirms tracheal intubation.
Now, here's the nuance, the thing that separates basic from advanced understanding. CO2 confirms it's in the trachea, yes, but what potential danger still exists even with CO2 confirmation?
It does not guarantee correct position within the trachea itself. You can still have the tube too deep, usually down the right main stem bronchus because it branches off at a shallower angle.
And what happens then?
You'll only be ventilating the right lung. You'll likely hear decreased or absent breath sounds on the left side. So even with CO2 confirmed, you still need to assess depth.
How do you confirm the depth properly?
After you've ruled out esophageal intubation with CO2 and auscultation, the best way to confirm proper depth, usually about 2 centimeters above the carina where the trachea splits, is with a chest x-ray. That comes a bit later, but it's the definitive check for depth.
Okay, finally, let's tie this all together quickly with interprofessional management. Because managing a trauma airway is never a one-person show, right? It's pure teamwork.
Absolutely critical. The team leader needs to know who the designated expert airway manager is before the patient even hits the door. Their expertise needs to be established.
Preparation is key.
Definitely. If RSI is even a possibility, those drugs Etomidate, succinylcholine, rescue meds need to be drawn up and ready early. Don't wait until the last second.
And during transfers, that seems like a high-risk time.
Huge risk for tube displacement. The team leader must explicitly state who is responsible for monitoring that airway, watching the tube, the capnography, the patient during every single handover or transfer, to CT, to the OR, to the ICU. Responsibility can't be ambiguous. It has to be crystal clear.
We took a really complex, truly life or death topic and hopefully distilled it down to the essential high yield actions for acute care. Let's quickly hit those most testable concepts again, like NCLEX style cues.
Okay. Priority Q1. Secure the airway, ensure adequate ventilation. This comes before absolutely everything else. Your first move determines survival.
Assessment cue, a clear verbal response. Good sign for the moment, airway, breathing, brain perfusion are okay right now, but watch out. Agitation likely means hypoxia. Getting quiet, obtunded, likely means hypercarbia.
Intervention cue, suspected C-spine injury, mandatory motion restriction during all airway maneuvers if they vomit, suction immediately and log roll the entire patient laterally while maintaining that restriction.
Safety cue. Always use lemon to predict difficulty. If you paralyze someone for RSI, you must have a rescue plan ready, bag mask first, then maybe an LMA as a bridge, or be ready for that surgical cricothyroidotomy. Remember, needle crick, PTO is temporary, not definitive.
Verification cue. Confirm tube placement always with capnography, CO2 detection, and bilateral breath sounds before you fully secure that tube. Double, triple check.
Connecting this to the bigger picture, it really seems like the core takeaway is anticipation, doesn't it? So many preventable deaths seem to come from failing to anticipate things getting worse, like with inhalation injuries, or failing to anticipate a difficult airway, which is exactly what lemon helps us avoid.
Exactly. So the question we want to leave you with is this. Think about your own setting. Are your equipment, your protocols, and your personal knowledge for managing a failed intubation attempt just as ready, just as well practiced as your primary plan A? Is your rescue plan truly ready to go?
Something to really think about. Thank you for diving deep with us today. Go out there and use this knowledge wisely.